Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer.
And I'm Araceli Gomez Aldana. WBOI listeners have probably heard from Martin Fisher, in addition to being the executive director of Science Central, one of the only science centers in the tri-state area. Fisher also hosts the weekly experiment on Saturday afternoons right here on WBOI. I sat down with him this week to talk about some of the biggest science moments of 2017, as well as the importance of science literacy. Martin Fisher, thank you for being with us here today for WBOI Presents. We appreciate you taking the trip.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to this. You know, we're talking about science, and as you know, that's my favorite subject.
Let's start with the biggest science stories that pop out at you from this past year.
We had both good things and bad things that were happening. I mean, we're on planet Earth. It's a living, breathing, active, sometimes nasty planet with all the things going on. We have things going on underground, volcanism. We have things going on up above with weather events. So two of them that come to mind right off the bat are, of course, there were quite a few hurricanes this year that were powerful, damaging, dangerous. And Houston was devastated. And a couple of weeks later, another one was hitting Florida. In fact, we were watching it live at Science Central on one of our exhibits. We have a giant exhibit, 6-foot globe suspended from the ceiling with 4 projectors, 2 projectors on each wall. And we can connect live time with that exhibit to National Weather Service satellites. And we were watching these hurricanes as they were forming, moving across the ocean, and then moving across towards land and then dissipating after they hit the land. We're still, to this day, we still have damage that is going on, trying to repair, clean up, replace things. And that amounts to, you know, billions of dollars worth of damage for each of those hurricanes. The second one, this was pretty exciting, was we had a total solar eclipse visible over most of the continental United States. Now, there are eclipses that occur all the time. Lunar eclipses, of course, but solar eclipses, it's not as common for them to be seen over a heavily populated area. Yeah, there are solar eclipses that occur pretty much every year, but hey, unless you're lucky enough to be on a high-end cruise ship in the middle of the ocean that was scheduled to go and see that eclipse, or maybe you're in a very remote area of Siberia or Antarctica, you know, it's not that often that it's seen over a heavily populated area. But this summer in August, we had one that went across the middle of the U.S. and up into Canada. And it went across the middle of the U.S. from northwest U.S. towards the southeast. So really, a majority of America was able to see it. And I, like so many of my colleagues in the sciences, tried to go down to an area called totality. That means that that's where the actual path of the shadow is occurring and moving across the country. And of course, it was cloudy, the moment of totality. So I and my family and probably 15,000 other people who were at that site all groaned at the same time. But the thing that made it exciting for me as a science educator, even though I was in the wrong spot, that's kind of irrelevant. I still had fun, still got to see most of the sun being covered up by the moon. It really brought a level of excitement of astronomy, space sciences, to most of the country. I mean, think about it. Back in the 60s, everyone was excited by the space research going on, the space race going on with the Soviet Union, the landing on the moon. And then in the 80s, of course, we had the space shuttle and everything that it was discovering. So this was back in the public eye. It was on the news for weeks, every day, pretty much leading up to the event and even afterwards. It was a very exciting thing for the general population and general excitement about science.
I do want to shift the conversation now and talk about science literacy. We heard about global warming a lot in the news throughout 2017. I'm not going to ask you if you believe in it, because I think that would be a political question, but I will ask you.
But it isn't for scientists.
It's not, yes.
It is not at all for scientists. So I think I probably should mention that or address that. In the areas of science, there are certain areas which are very exciting to scientists. They like to do the research. They like find. That's the thing that makes a scientist. We like to question. We like to ask and get information. But anyone can do that. The thing that makes science so fascinating is anyone can reproduce what a scientist has learned about, discovered, found, and published. You and I can go to any of those journal publications because they're peer-reviewed. Other scientists have looked at what were the methods, what were the materials, how did that scientist or team of scientists write up their research and then publish it so it's available for anyone to be able to see. If you and I were to get the same equipment, do the same controlled experiments, we should get the same results. That's what makes science itself so powerful and so worthwhile. In the areas of environmental degradation, global warming, climate change, it's an area of enormous research. And this research is being done by university researchers, government researchers, researchers and scientists here in the United States, research and scientists all over the world. And they start to put models together. They take data from what they see in the environment and they will create a model of, okay, so what could happen if this has changed a little bit? So I'm making this up. For example, what if a portion of the ocean were to warm up by half a degree centigrade? What are the models of what could occur? And then the scientists will go out and gather more data to see, is this occurring? Is whatever the model predicted occurring? And it turns out that a lot of these models are occurring. So there's more than enough data and research in regard to global climate change that, yeah, something's going on. There is more than enough scientific data and research to be able to support it. That's not a political thing at all. It's actually irrelevant in terms of politics. Scientists, you know, we're kind of nerdy. We pay more attention, I suppose, to the research and the data and the excitement of learning about new discoveries, whether it's about deep oceans or whether it's about, you know, deep space. That's the stuff that excites a lot of the scientists. They're data-driven.
What ways can people become more science literate, and how can science literacy impact our society?
The more that anybody knows about science, the better their lives will be. Think about it just like mathematics, basic mathematics. If you don't even know the basics of how to add, subtract, you can't even balance your own checkbook. But if you know more about math, if you know more about science, and I'm not talking, do you need to read all the research journals? No, not at all. Do you need to understand the basics of oceanography, meteorology, genetics, astronomy, et cetera, et cetera? If you know just the basics of what is it, how's it occurring, what might it mean? How does it relate to your lives? That's the important thing. And the more that you know, yes, it will impact your lives. The more that you know about science, it will impact where are you going to move? Where do you want your kid to go to school? What politician do you want to vote for in the next election, whether it's local, state, or national? What are the hobbies that you want to do that might have an impact on your life and the lives of other people because of the chemicals that it uses or the activities that it does? The more that you know about science, the more that it will impact you as a person, as a family. What are you going to eat for supper? I wonder what kind of chemicals this has or could contain. What are we going to do this weekend? I wonder what kind of an impact that might have.
All important questions.
All important questions. And it's all based upon knowing the basics about science. So getting back to your question about science literacy, what are the ways to do it? It's really simple. Next time that you're listening to an WBOI article and it's about science, pay a little bit of attention to it. The next time that you're watching the national news and you hear an article about science, pay attention to it. The next time that you're reading a magazine, decide, do I want to pick up National Geographic or Sports Illustrated? Well, maybe you start off with the National Geographic article to learn a little bit about the world, nature, science.
Martin Fisher, thanks for joining us on WBOI Presents.
My pleasure. Looking forward to when we do this in a year from now and look forward to 2019.
Yay!
Yay!
Thank you. An extended version of my conversation with Martin Fisher will be available later this week on WBOI.org. We all benefit from the variety of topics NPR and WBOI cover throughout the year that allows us to dedicate a portion of our time to keeping you up to date on what's going on in science as well as arts and culture. WBOI's Julia Meek recently sat down with Ben Clemmer, the producer of this program, to look back at some of 2017's most memorable arts and culture moments.
Julia Meek, welcome to WBOI Presents.
Thank you, Ben. As always, it's a pleasure to be here.
You spent much of 2017 covering arts and culture stories all over the region, but the 07 neighborhood does seem to have been at the center of a lot of goings-on. Some older buildings in the 07 neighborhood have always served the same function under the same name. Others have been renovated and or are being updated to have another chance at life. The 07 pub opened this past summer after renovation of what was once Lombardo's Lounge. And Julia, you got to speak to one of the pub's co-owners, Clancy Shank. What does the new pub bring to the community in the 07?
I'm really, really happy to say a fresh take on a wonderful old tradition and a great shot in the arm to the whole Southside social scene and spirit. Clancy and his partner, Marcus Spilson, are young Southsiders and made their lifelong dream come true by purchasing and refurbishing a nearly 100-year-old tavern building at the foot of Broadway.
Isn't that an ambitious undertaking?
Mighty ambitious, Ben. But their own neighborhood pride and no fear for hard work, I guess you might say, and hands-on DIY determination have really paid off. They also both have wonderful sense of humor, which I think helps a lot, too. Inside and out, that pub is 21st century 07 savvy, if I do say so myself, and their pub fare is fantastic. Their clientele in a usually full house is, as they describe it, 21 to 91, definitely. It's a grand new tradition to a grand old neighborhood.
And just across the river from the 07 pub is Quimby Village, and we'll get to one of the largest renovation projects there in a minute. Earlier this year, you spoke with Jeff and Ben Hall about the family business and the fact that an old school serving style is coming back.
Well, speaking of wonderful old traditions, Ben, when Don Hall's original drive-in opened its doors back in 1946, car hops were delivering food to curbside customers, American graffiti style, you might say, and locally, buzzing halls became the thing to do. Nationwide frenzy, to be sure. Now, the Halls family, more than 70 very successful years and three generations later, wanted to celebrate their steadfast community support and, again, that really rich Southside heritage. So they're saluting that unique neighborhood with an equally unique tradition. And Don Hall's original drive-in is literally living up to its name.
Halls remains a fixture, continuing with its drive-in traditions, but some old spaces are being renovated and updated. How are things going with the Clyde Theater at Quimby Village?
Well, thanks to this year's flurry of downtown redevelopment funding and new equity partners Chuck and Lisa Surak of Sweetwater Sound, Rick Kinney's dream to renovate that long-vacant, once-iconic Clyde Theater really is going full speed ahead. Besides major exterior renovations and new parking lot surface and a lot of things you have to do just to get the whole thing ready to be utilized, the painters are currently working overtime to bring the sensational 1951 Art Deco industrial interior back to its original stellar finish. The building itself was designed by Alvin Max Strauss and is quite a spectacular example from back in that day, and Kinney and crew hope to be up and running by this summer. Personally, I can't wait till it opens, and we won't have to wait that long. And you know, Ben, speaking of musical milestones, and speaking of everything that happened last year, you got up close for two intense days of music festivities at Middle Waves this past September. For those who might have missed it, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about the setup down at Headwaters?
Well, Headwaters Park is often home to festivals over the summer. You've got Greek Fest, Rib Fest. I mean, there's so many festivals. But Middle Waves brought a vibe and a setup that exceeded all expectations I had, and this was my first year attending Middle Waves. But you had the small city benefits of never being too far away from anything, and getting from one stage to another was easy. But we also had some acts from all over the country. I talked to one festival goer who described Middle Waves as the national music scene locating itself in Fort Wayne for 2 days, and I completely agree with that description.
A very good way to describe it. Who were some of the highlights of the bands you saw?
There were so many. I heard it once heard it described that trying to explain music with words is like trying to explain different types of architecture through dance, but I'll do my best. Row and Sidewalk Chalk came out of nowhere for me. I don't really listen to a ton of rap and hip-hop and R&B myself. I just don't have a lot of experience with the genre, but hearing Row and Sidewalk Chalk at Middleway has made me realize I need to change that. They're both based out of Chicago, so I hope to catch them again soon. Flynn Eastwood came to Middleways from Detroit. I bought a lot of their music after I saw them on Friday night. Their front woman, Jax Anderson, is incredibly charismatic. Her presence energized the Mommy stage, and again, it was a chance to experience a genre I don't know very well. Flynn Eastwood's dance jams were amazing. The crowd was into it throughout, and the consensus from a lot of people I talked to was that Flynn Eastwood absolutely owned Friday. On Saturday, I got to experience the Lemon Twigs, who are more similar to what I usually listen to. They sound like they came out of the 60s and 70s through a time warp. The band is fronted by Brian and Michael Deodario, and they both play drums and guitar, and they're both younger than me. I feel like they impressed everyone on Saturday, and then, of course, MGMT came out and owned the stage to close the show.
Local talent as well?
Oh, man, there were so many local bands that were showcased, but it was my first time hearing Fatima Washington. And I already thought she was a great singer, and then, of course, I got to hear her again at Sister Act. She was another R&B influence, and I thought she was easily on the same level as some of the national acts that came through.
I think that's one great thing about this Middle Waves Festival and about, of course, our own music scene. So, any recommendations for those attending next year?
The festival organizers deliberately set up everything to make it look like kind of a choose-your-own-adventure. I would encourage anyone who attends to take full advantage of that. Two of the three stages are free. You can walk up and walk out if there's another band you want to see. Food trucks at the pavilion are close by, such as Bravas, just in case we didn't have enough references to the 07 neighborhood in this conversation. And it's really hard to go wrong with how much talent they pack into the place. In every area, whether that's music or amenities, it's just all done first class. If I'm scheduling Middleways for next year, I would try to book Addison Egan. The voice runner-up probably doesn't need an introduction for many in our area, but nonetheless, let's provide one. How long have you been following Addison's work?
Well, you know, I've had the pleasure of knowing Addison since she was very young, as well as her music, and that's an amusing thought, as she is very young. But her musical passion began around 2 years of age, and her performing around 4. And the first time I had her into our own WBOI Meet the Music soundstage, she was the ripe old age of 13. So I guess everything's relative, but she's a sweetheart. And yes, I've had the proud pleasure of knowing her and loving her work and her spirit a long time.
We do have our own show coming up featuring Addison Egan. So care to tell our listeners more about that?
Michael Kelsey, Addison Egan, and Sonny Taylor will be on our own benefit concert stage at Sweetwater Sound on Saturday, February 17th. You can rest assured it's going to be an extraordinary and magnificent night of music with its own meet and greet and one fine benefit for homegrown public radio goodness, WBOI style, all in one night.
Certainly a lot to look forward to there. What do you think is next for her? When your music is charting alongside national acts, the sky's the limit.
You know, I believe the sky is the limit for Addison, Ben, and it's an abundantly sunny horizon. She's an amazing singer-songwriter, to be sure, but more than that, she's a remarkable person and a born storyteller and a very beautiful soul. Already well on the way to realizing her dream before her odyssey on The Voice, Addison is a bright and shining star, a winner in every sense of the word, and I am so proud that she's one of Fort Wayne's very own.
Julia Meek, thank you for joining us on WBOI Presents.
My pleasure, Ben. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Stay with us. Coming up next, Zach Bernard speaks with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman about some of the biggest stories to impact Indiana this year. We'll also introduce the newest member of the WBOI News team, our news director, Rebecca Green. All that's still to come after this short break.
Used to be